You're listening to Seeking Office, the Vancouver Municipal Election Podcast. This interview was originally broadcast on Thursday, August 9th on CITR 101.9 FM as part of Democracy Watch. It has been edited for clarity. Could you say your name on tape and then also just say where we are and why we're here, please? Okay.
So my name is Rohan Rizal. I'm at the candidates 101 session at the town, at the city hall, where they talked about what's involved in running for office at the upcoming election.
How would you situate yourself on like a political spectrum? Would you say you're closely aligned with any one party?
I wouldn't say that I'm closely aligned with any one party. I'd definitely say that I'm not aligned with NPA or Vision Vancouver. They're tainted. They have taken too much money from the real estate industry to be a credible party. I've had conversations with the remaining parties, and I really like of the parties that are running mayoral candidates, because COPE is not running a mayoral candidate, as you are aware. Professor Condon had to drop out for health reasons, and I wish him a speedy recovery. Great guy, I know him. And so of the parties that are running mayoral candidates, the only party that I can really feel any affinity towards is Pro Vancouver. That's David Chen's party. Because COPE is not running a mayoral candidate, Green Party is not running a mayoral candidate, One City is not running a mayoral candidate. So that really leaves you with just David Chen as the untainted candidate at this election.
This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alex DeBoer. I'm here with Zoe Power and Olamide Olanian and also Zubin Shroff-Marabadi. And we just heard a clip. That was pro-Vancouver City Council candidate Rohana Rezel. He was talking with myself, Alex DeBoer, outside of City Hall about 3 weeks to a month ago. And Rohana is now joining mayoral candidate David Chen and City Council candidates Breton Krellen and Raza Mirza, as well as school board candidate Tiffany Kindred on the pro-Vancouver slate. So in April, pro-Vancouver joined a somewhat crowded race for office in Vancouver's 2018 civic election. And pro-Vancouver, led by mayoral candidate David Chen, has said they aspire to build strong communities and maintain transparency in City Hall. Four pillars of their platform include housing affordability, making the city livable, building a responsive City Hall, and enhancing business development. So in addition to this platform, Pro Vancouver has stood out by asserting that they are neither a left-wing nor a right-wing political party. So we have David Chen on the line with us to talk about all this and more. Hello, David Chen. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you for your patience in setting this call up and for joining us on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Awesome. So first of all, I just wanted to ask to clarify, is Pro Vancouver an actual political party or is it just a group?
So we're an umbrella organization that links independents together. And because of that, we came up with the concept that in real life, nobody really uses a political spectrum to decide how they deal with things. I mean, if you ask yourself that when you decide what you want to do that day, go out, whatever, we don't look at are we left, are we right. So what we do is we're going through a process of saying, what is the problem, what is the need, and how do we solve this? And being able to pick from anywhere within a political spectrum actually makes us much stronger in developing the right solution to meet the needs of the time.
Okay, yeah. When I hear you saying that, what it kind of reminds me of is Hector Bremner and Yes Vancouver, because I think they would say a very similar thing, as their party is the other political party that has also said they're neither left nor right wing. Would you say that you're essentially positioned the same as Yes Vancouver, or how are you different?
Well, I think there's a few things that we have to acknowledge. We actually came out first. Pro Vancouver, if you look at the structure of the name of the organization, Yes Vancouver copied that. So It's hard to say that we're the same in the sense that if they copied us, we can't prevent that. But, you know, when we look at everything, we came up with a concept that we don't want to be blindsided. Everything in nature goes through cycles. There's always an equilibrium, and we want to make sure that we're not extreme in any way, but we are able to actually meet the needs of the time as it pops up. So that means that as things cycle, we're not going to be 180 degrees outside of the need with regards to solutions to, for the people.
Right. Okay. So you have a similar name. It's a, you know, positive Vancouver, pro Vancouver, yes Vancouver, and you both are neither left nor right wing. But what, like, have you been paying attention to Yes Vancouver? Do you find that a lot of their platforms, which include sort of deregulating development in the city and having less single family zoning and having more like economic stimulus, is that similar to what pro Vancouver wants to do, or are there Go ahead.
They're very different. I mean, everybody is dealing with key topics within the city, and those topics are not going to change. The actual solution that's being delivered is very different from party to party. You look at Yes Vancouver and Hector Bremner, even when he was still affiliated with the NPA and trying to get the mayoral nomination, he was always about supply. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is that the equation isn't really an equation of supply. It's more about demand and also money supply. So you need to ask yourself a very basic question, which is, who do you actually know that can afford to pay cash for a property and leave it empty? Mm-hmm. I certainly don't know anybody like that. So this is that unknown thing that nobody wants to fess up to, which is we have a problem with unregulated global capital. And if what you're trying to do is to meet a supply to an insatiable demand from the globe, and that also includes interprovincial, that becomes a very difficult equation to satisfy. So what actually needs to happen is we need to intervene with a certain type of supply, not just supply in general, but a certain type of supply that will tend to put a pressure on the pricing in Vancouver for housing to actually bring that down.
Right, and how will that happen? Like, what is this particular type of supply?
So, first of all, we've gone on record by saying that Metro Vancouver did a study, which was quite interesting, that said that around transit hubs, they find that there's a lot of market speculation. But the problem is that the housing that's built around those hubs, typically they're at market rates, which means that the people in them actually aren't real transit users. And so even if you vary the income up or down, they found that transit use did not change. Whereas if we actually do what we said on record is that we are going to use the new powers that the province has given the city to actually purposely zone those areas to be rental only, then what happens is it changes the equation. We found that renters will typically use transit more. And that's exactly what we want to have happen, so that transit can actually support itself, so that it is being used, and so that traffic ends up decreasing within the city. Mm. And that's not something that Hector Bremner and Yes Vancouver are talking about.
Right. And I know that you've also said that you would like future development, housing development in the city to be mandated to have 50% rental. So how would you do that? Is that like, would that be hard to work out with developers? How would you make that happen?
Well, there's a lot of things that we have to first look at. So when we're talking about social housing and those that work within a development process, they know that there are a lot of concessions that the city can give to make projects affordable in terms of the calculations actually working out. But there's also another thing, and I went to public meetings or public hearings with regards to this, and I said that, you know, when you're talking about social housing, nowhere in that term does it say profitability. And especially with developers, when they have multiple developments and we're looking at specific ones that are earmarked for social housing and for affordability, nowhere in that equation does it say that they need to have a high profitability, nor that they can't write off even losses within those projects with other projects that they hold. That's a very normal business concept. So really what we're looking at is we're saying, okay, we want a more level playing field. We don't want key developers that are having carte blanche to do whatever the heck they want to have that any longer. But we want to have a transparency. We want a fair competition process. We want something that says, okay, we're in this together for everybody, not just for profitability.
Okay. I'm going to just go back a sec for when you were saying that when we were talking about building housing that is 50% rental. So you were saying how housing doesn't always need to be, like building housing doesn't always have to be profitable or have that as its main priority. So that's fine, but would it still be profitable if we were doing that with all new development to mandate that it's 50% rental? Or would you still allow some sections of the city to be built as purchase only, like condos? Like, would you zone the city differently or would that be the entire city?
Well, remember the term 50% rental doesn't mean that a building has to be split in half. It's 50% rental and 50% market.
Okay.
You can still have in a numbers game a building that is completely rental and other buildings that are completely market.
Right, okay.
But again, the point is to balance this all off. We have to look at what is the profitability and what is the impact costing. And also, we have to open up this competition. There are actually a lot of mid-tier developers that are trying to do the right thing, and they're struggling because there are actually top-tier developers that get carte blanche. And so when you look at that, I mean, that's sort of an anti-competitive process to have that. And when you open up a competitive process, what typically happens is prices come down and a lot of times qualities go up because competition exists.
Right.
And that's really what we're looking for, is to make sure that we have that balance. So the reason why we need the 50% rentals is we know that statistically in Vancouver, 53% of the residents are renters. And the rental stock is way below that number. So we need to up that number in order to meet that demand.
Right. So does that include rezoning, single family housing, which makes up 75% of the city?
Yeah. So rezoning will still have to be looked at in terms of the community plan. We're not going to go into this shotgun blanket rezoning that's occurring right now in City Hall, which can have a lot of negative effects, including the communities are not being consulted. But worse, that in that process, a lot of times there is a massive discount or a complete loss to levies that go to the developer that are actually required to build the community amenities like community centers and daycares and whatnot. So we can't go through a process of just saying we're going to shotgun do all this. But we want to have a community action plan that has taken into account the zones, the people there, and what direction the city is going at, and use that as a basis to plan out how we're going to deal with the zoning.
One question to follow up on what you were saying about bringing in new types of developers to build in Vancouver and bringing in new types of investment firms. In the past, we've seen, I mean, regardless of who's actually behind projects that undertake to maintain a certain ratio of social housing in the city, whatever commitments have been undertaken, and we've seen this, for example, at the Olympic Village site, probably in the most high-profile way, these commitments and targets of social or non-market housing have ended up being eroded over the course of the project. And more often than not, the entire project has ended up going for market rate housing and for the most part for sale rather than for rental. So what would you and what would Pro Vancouver do to sort of buck this trend and make sure that these new targets you're setting are actually enforced and mandated?
So one of the things that is attached to sort of this responsive administration within City Hall is we are looking at a concept of fast-tracking developers that are actually playing according to the rules. And in business, time is money. So anytime anybody gets slowed down, it will cost them. So when we look at this concept in terms of your question of enforcement, well, guess what? If the social housing component of a mixed development is not respected and it doesn't come out that way, we can very easily not fast track that developer in the future and give an advantage to one that has played by those rules. And at the end of the day, Vancouver City Council actually has to be the boss that is responding to the ultimate boss, which is the voter, the people that reside within Vancouver. It shouldn't be the other way around where council is responding to developers.
In the recent past, in the Vancouver housing market in particular, time equals money, the normal kind of equation that we go by, has been somewhat distorted by the fact that the appreciation in housing values has almost so much as doubled over the course of a year, which would I guess, kind of reduce the power of fast-tracking as a disciplinary measure. So what other kinds of policies would pro-Vancouver be bringing in to end that sort of speculation and the constant blooming of the housing bubble here in Vancouver?
Well, don't forget that the city still has the power of rezoning. They don't have to grant future zoning for developer projects. They don't have to grant development permits. They don't have to do a lot of things. And so I hear what you're saying that, you know, within a market that is appreciating that fast, is there still an enforcement threat from the city or the ability to put some pressure on the system? And I would wager that there is, because for one project, maybe not if it's in process. But for other projects that are coming online, I think that there's a lot of bargaining power that the city actually has if it has a willpower to keep control.
Something that I'm interested in that I talked with Rohanna a bit about outside City Hall is the idea that, or the reality that pro-Vancouver doesn't really have a sort of catchy slogan or some sort of flashy kind of go-to phrase. And one thing he was telling myself and Andy, the other News Collective member, about is that pro-Vancouver is in a way nonpartisan, and so people within the party wouldn't necessarily have to vote together. Is that true? And if so, can you tell me a bit more about that?
Absolutely. So within our constitution, when we built the organization, one of the things that we were responding to, and this just gives you a bit of the history, we knew that there were other influential people within the community that got reprimanded for joining other parties just because they supported certain individuals that were running them by elections. And we looked at that saying, well, you know, if someone doesn't fully resonate with a group, they should be allowed to participate with other groups and they should not be reprimanded for that. So within the Constitution, we did not put in any clause that says if you're part of another party, you cannot be part of pro-Vancouver. So that's the first level that says we're open. Hmm. The second thing we built into the Constitution was the concept that there's no party line to toe. We're looking at a concept that we want a true democratic process to exist, not only in what our elected officials may do, but what is also occurring within the party. So all we've asked is three things of anybody that's affiliated with a party. First, we want integrity. Second, we want transparency. And third, we want to understand the logic of why a vote was done. And even if that vote is contrary to the group, if those three principles are upheld, then that individual should have the right to do that. I mean, we look at a council and we can't always expect perfect agreement. But if someone has a concern and perhaps the solution that the council is putting on the table does not meet that individual's concern, I would say that that person should have the right to vote their conscience. Should they not?
I mean, this reminds me a bit of an interview that myself and Zoe recently did with a political scientist at the University of Calgary named Jack Lucas. And he was telling us about how this sort of history of municipal politics, at least in Canada, has had people thinking that local politics shouldn't be partisan, that the quote he said is, there is no left or right wing way to fill a pothole. So this kind of reminds me of maybe a move back towards that.
Absolutely. I mean, when we formed pro-Vancouver, it was not with the concept to form a traditional party. It was to give a common platform and infrastructure for independents to come together and work together. And from that, we also realized that on a ballot, especially with randomized names, the only other thing that we can put on there that would identify the people that are coming together with a common goal is an organizational name. And that is why pro-Vancouver was formed.
Right.
We have no real interest to force people to toe a party line. Mm-hmm. Because when you do that, especially if you're on one polar extreme or the other, like I said, as things change over time, at some point in time, the group's going to be 180 degrees out of phase with what's needed within society.
Right. Another of your platforms, one that is, I believe, different from Yes, Vancouver, because you both are focused on, everyone's focused on housing affordability, obviously, and livability and enhancing business. Obviously, Yes, Vancouver is very into that as well. But one of your other points is creating a responsive city hall. And I know this is something Rohanna spoke about as well, is that there was a lack of transparency. And he felt also a lack of communication, like he would put forward criticisms or critiques or insights he had from, you know, his professional perspective and not kind of hear back or not get a response. And so I'm wondering if that is a tenet of your party, sort of how would you achieve that in City Hall? And what tell us a bit more about what that means, being responsive.
So there's a few things. I mean, again, given the back history, a lot of people complain about the fact that when you're applying for things at City Hall, it's very much a paper-based process, at least in the beginning. And maybe it shouldn't be, because there are transcription errors that occur when you do that. There are problems with multiple applications. So let's say, for example, if a developer wants to put 10 applications in, why do they need to have 10 paper-based applications for the same standard set of information, who the developer is, where they're located, blah, blah, blah. So if we digitize it, create a profile, we found from past examples in organizations where they cut down 50% of their processing time was related to that very question, the same question that's repeated on every single application. Second thing is, from my industry, dealing with life insurance, I've seen a evolution from a very paper-based underwriting process to a very electronic underwriting process. And so what it does is, when questions are asked electronically, the computer can actually red flag files. So if no red flags pop up, the file is approved and it goes straight through, and it gets into the hands of the people that need it as a permit. But if something shows up as a red flag, it can go to secondary inspection, where a set of human eyes actually looks at it and just says, is this something that is a concern or not a concern?
Okay, right. So you're talking about digitizing City Hall applications and creating sort of electronic flagging systems.
Yeah, and also using like a nexus principle that says, okay, if you're a reputable firm, you're using reputable architects and engineers, and nothing's a problem, we can accelerate you through the process. But this is what we're going to do different that ICBC did not do when they tried to do something like this. We do spot audits. So just like Nexus, if anything goes wrong in the process, you now completely lose that express ability and you'll go to the back of the line. So we need there to be some skin in the game for those developers and architects and engineers that are coming together to try and put an application through, to not slide something through that is questionable or is problematic with regards to the development application.
Right. And is transparency also a key part of making City Hall more responsive?
So some of the challenges that we see is that there's too much requirement to go through a Freedom of Information Act to pull records. And so there is a huge desire within the community and with tech people that look at what's going on to actually make all those records available so that you can just go online and search yourself if you're looking for financial statements or agreements or whatever. Anything that has been completed in terms of a process. So, I mean, I understand that there is a requirement to have some confidentiality with certain processes that are in play. This is a normal business thing. But once it's done, just like the provincial and federal government, these documents should be released to the public. They shouldn't be behind a wall of, we now have to go to an FOI counter and ask for that document. And that's what we're saying will change the transparency process. Another thing that we really like is this concept that if council members make a decision in any hearing or a council meeting, that they actually put in writing why they made that decision so that the public can actually see, are the council members actually making decisions that have the best interests of the public at heart, or is there some other ulterior motive?
Okay. I'm wondering, with the election coming up and so many parties in it and parties that have headed the polls, at least in terms of the mayoral seat, the people who I think the top two are Ken Sim and then Kennedy Stewart, and then there's below that, like Ian Campbell, and you know, you're somewhere near the end. I'm just wondering if you see your run for mayor and Pro Vancouver's purpose as being to put forward important issues that will kind of move from the fringe to the mainstream and to kind of open up that dialogue for future elections, more so than actually winning and taking seats on council or becoming the mayor.
Well, we're in this to actually win. And so when we look at polls, we look at it with a grain of salt, because at the end of the day, we've seen in past elections where, let's say, for example, the NDP were supposed to win by a landslide and they didn't. You know, polls, they dictate what may be happening at the moment the question was asked. And, you know, coming from a statistics background, I can tell you that polls can be very, very deceptive, because it depends on how the question was asked. And when you ask those questions that double check the accuracy, if those questions were not asked in a way that is understandable to the public, you may get very conflicting information. So, for example, one of our party members was talking about some stats about a study that was done about bike lanes and how 61% of Vancouverites favor it. But when I look at the opposing question, it said, well, 47% were opposed to it. Well, if I had 47 to 61, I'd come to 108. So what is the answer? Is it the 61 actually approve of it? Or is it because, you know, they've asked a question in a funny way that people don't really understand how to answer? So really, again, when we look at polls, even online, so I know that a social media poll was done about all of the mayor candidates. And from that poll, actually, Kennedy and myself came out on top. None of the other candidates actually even came close. So what is it? I don't know.
I was just going to say, do you feel like as a mayoral candidate with Pro Vancouver, you're being represented in the media as widely as, say, someone like Kennedy Stewart?
Well, I can say that from people that ask me how come they don't see us in the media as much, we're probably not being talked about as equally. But at the same time, it's interesting because within our own canvassing efforts, we are getting people that are very, very open to our concept. We're not a difficult sell. And when we also introduce ourselves, I'm finding that there's actually more people that know about us than we actually expected, even based on sort of the poll that has been published in the papers. So really that does beg the question, A, are we actually that far behind? And B, like you've asked, are we actually being fairly talked about within the media? And, you know, based on the evidence, I would say no to both.
Interesting. Yeah. I really appreciate the time you've taken to chat with us, and we'll be watching your party as the election comes closer.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much, David. Thank you for listening. This interview was conducted by me, Alex DeBoer, and Zoe Power. Live tech support by Alameda Lanyon. Special thanks to the News Collective and CITR 101.9 FM. Seeking Office is brought to you by CITR's News Collective and produced by Alex DeBoer. Our theme music is by Artem Bemba. Thank you for listening.